Lincoln, Disc 32.
The November elections were principally responsible for the change. It was one thing for Republican congressmen to break with the head of their own party when he appeared to be a failure, whose bid for re-election was doomed to disgraceful defeat. It was quite another to defy a president recently re-elected by a huge majority with a clear popular mandate. Republicans also found it easier to go along with the president's wishes on Reconstruction, because circumstances had changed since the previous summer. While the Congress was debating the proposed 13th Amendment and Ashley's Reconstruction bill, it was also moving, with the president's blessing, to create the new Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, intended to supervise the transition from slavery to freedom in the South. This Freedmen's Bureau Act, which gave the federal authorities guardianship over the recently emancipated slaves in order to protect them from exploitation by their former owners, made it easier for Republican congressmen to accept even imperfect Reconstruction governments in the South, since they would be shorn of much of their power. The adoption of the 13th Amendment provided another incentive for Republicans to recognize the Reconstruction regimes Lincoln had established. Before that amendment could go into effect, it had to be ratified by 27 of the 36 states. Illinois, as Lincoln proudly reported, began the process on February 1st, and the other northern states were sure to follow promptly. The border states of Maryland, West Virginia, and Missouri had all now abolished slavery, and they were expected to ratify it. But slavery persisted in Delaware and Kentucky, and the outcome in those states was doubtful. Even if they both approved, the votes of two additional states were needed, and those votes could only come from states that had been in the Confederacy. The most likely possibilities were Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee. By recognizing the regimes that Lincoln had created in those states, congressmen could ensure the speedy death of slavery throughout the nation. Congressmen, then, were in a receptive mood toward presidential Reconstruction, and Lincoln, who'd had very little to do with earlier congressional deliberations on the subject, now presented his case with great skill and force. He addressed the concerns of radicals who were beginning to argue that the only way to protect the rights of African Americans in the South was to give them the ballot. Lincoln assured William D. Kelly that he too now believed in Negro suffrage, at least for the better educated and those who'd served in the Union armies. And he showed the Pennsylvania congressman a copy of his letter to Governor Hahn of Louisiana, suggesting limited enfranchisement of blacks. Radical Senator B. Gretz Brown also saw a copy of that letter and quoted from it in urging his Missouri constituents to accept enfranchisement of Negroes as an imperative necessity admitted on all sides. To present to Congress the more attractive side of the Reconstruction government in Louisiana, Lincoln detained N.P. Banks in Washington for 6 months so that the general, who'd once been Speaker of the House of Representatives and still kept up his political contacts in the Capitol, could lobby in behalf of the regime he'd helped to create. The president was also prepared to use brass-knuckle tactics if necessary. When the radical abolitionists Wendell Phillips and George Luther Stearns tried to organize a protest against recognition of the Louisiana regime, they got nowhere. Congressmen told them, Abraham Lincoln has just now all the great offices to give afresh, and can't be successfully resisted. He's dictator. This combination of forces was strong enough to enable Lincoln to keep control of the Reconstruction process in his own hands. But it was not quite enough to secure congressional approval of his actions. After the failure of Ashley's Reconstruction bill in mid-February, administration supporters moved to secure the admission of Louisiana. Lyman Trumbull, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, took the lead. In the past, he'd often been a severe, even waspish, critic of the president. But his attitude had remarkably softened since November. He seemed to have experienced what Ben Wade called the most miraculous conversion that has taken place since St. Paul's time. Possibly he recalled that his next race for the Senate would occur while Lincoln was still in the White House. At any rate, Trumbull conferred with the president about recognizing the reconstructed government of Louisiana and seating its two recently elected senators. As usual, Lincoln cut through the legal verbiage that surrounded these issues and put the issue plainly. Can Louisiana be brought into proper practical relations with the Union sooner, by admitting or by rejecting the proposed senators? A clear majority of the Republicans in the Senate joined Trumbull in following the president's wishes. But a small group of radicals resolved to block the move. Joined by Wade, Grimes, and a few other radicals, Sumner began a filibuster against recognizing Louisiana that often deteriorated into an angry shouting match with the president's supporters. He blasted the pretended state government in Louisiana as a mere 7 months' abortion, begotten by the bayonet in criminal conjunction with the spirit of caste and born before its time, rickety, unformed, unfinished, whose continued existence will be a burden, a reproach, and a wrong. The radicals, who opposed the Louisiana regime because it didn't give African Americans the vote, worked in close cooperation with the Senate Democrats, who wanted to deny the suffrage to blacks. They shared only opposition to recognizing Lincoln's government in Louisiana. Because of pressing business that the Senate had to attend to before adjourning, Trumbull was forced to give way, and the admission of Louisiana was defeated. Lincoln was angry with Sumner. He hopes to succeed in beating the president so as to change this government from its original form and make it a strong, centralized power, he growled. According to Washington insiders, the cordial personal relations that had existed between the senator and Lincoln were at an end now that Sumner had kicked the pet scheme of the president down the marble steps of the Senate chamber. But Lincoln didn't permit a difference over policy to become a personal quarrel. He not only genuinely liked and admired Sumner, but he needed his support in the future. Only a few days after Sumner had talked the Louisiana bill to death, the president invited him to the inaugural ball, where the senator promenaded with Mrs. Lincoln, richly dressed in white moire, ornamented with lace, on his arm. The president could afford to be generous because he, like nearly everyone else, was certain that the next Congress would admit Louisiana. As the New York Herald predicted, this extraordinary rail splitter enters upon his second term the unquestioned master of the situation in reference to American affairs at home and abroad. Inauguration Day March 4, 1865, began wet and windy. It had been raining for several days in Washington, and the streets were a sea of mud, at least 10 inches deep. During the previous week, delegations from all parts of the country had been arriving in the capital, and all the hotels were full, with Willard's accommodating overflow guests on cots in the hallways and parlors. Despite the abominable weather, a crowd began to gather at the east front of the Capitol before 10 o'clock, and by the time the ceremonies began at noon, the spectators were sodden. Women, wearing their long, cumbersome dresses, were in a most wretched, wretched plight, Noah Brooks observed. Crinoline was smashed, skirts bedaubed, and moire, antique velvet laces and such dry goods were streaked with mud from end to end. First came the swearing-in of the vice president, which took place in the Senate chamber. Andrew Johnson had hoped to remain in Tennessee to witness the installation of a new, loyal state government under a constitution with the foul blot of slavery erased from her escutcheon, but Lincoln and his advisers felt that it was unsafe for him not to be in Washington on March 4th. Exhausted from the long trip, unsteady from a recent bout of typhoid fever, Johnson asked for some whiskey to calm his nerves. He was especially sensitive to alcohol, and the drink went to his head. In a long maudlin speech, he boasted of his plebeian origins and reminded the embarrassed members of the Supreme Court, the Cabinet, and even the diplomatic corps, with all your fine feathers and gewgaws, that they were but creatures of the people. Lincoln had to sit silently through Johnson's ramblings, and an observer noted that he closed his eyes and seemed to retire into himself, as though beset by melancholy reflections. When Johnson finally finished and took the oath, the president leaned over to the parade marshal and whispered, "Do not let Johnson speak outside." Then the presidential party moved onto the platform at the east front of the Capitol. As Lincoln's tall figure appeared, cheer upon cheer arose, bands blatted upon the air, and flags waved all over the scene. After the sergeant-at-arms of the Senate quieted the crowd, the president stepped forward, holding a half-sheet of foolscap on which his inaugural address was printed in two columns. At just that moment, the sun burst through the clouds and flooded the scene with light. Chief Justice Chase saw it as an auspicious omen of the dispersion of the clouds of war and the restoration of the clear sunlight of prosperous peace. In his clear, high-pitched voice that reached even the outer edges of the huge crowd, Lincoln read one of the shortest inaugural addresses in American history, 703 words, and also the most memorable. He began by reminding his listeners that at this time there was less occasion for an extended address outlining policy than there'd been at his first inauguration. During the past 4 years of war, he noted in a tone of weariness, public declarations have been constantly called forth on every point and phase of the great contest. Consequently, he could devote the larger part of his address to an explanation of the origins of the conflict and an examination of its significance. It was a remarkably impersonal address. After the opening paragraph, Lincoln didn't use the first-person singular pronoun, nor did he refer to anything he had said or done during the previous 4 years. Notably lacking from his brief account of how the war began was any attribution of blame. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. But one of the parties to the conflict, throughout he carefully avoided referring to the South or the Confederacy, would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. Interrupted by a burst of applause at this point, Lincoln continued, "And the war came. Slavery was somehow the cause of the war. It was the one institution that divided the nation. The people of both sections had shared values. They read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other." In his one deviation from impartiality between the sections, Lincoln felt obliged to remark that it may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But he promptly added, "Let us judge not, that we be not judged." Lincoln then sought, both for himself and for the American people, an explanation of why the war was so protracted. His answer showed no trace of any late-at-night anguish over his own responsibility for the conflict. If there was guilt, the burden had been shifted from his shoulders to those of a higher power. "The war continued because the Almighty has his own purposes, which are different from men's purposes." This, Lincoln said later, was a truth which I thought needed to be told, because to deny it was to deny that there is a God governing the world. He might have put his argument in terms of the doctrine of necessity, in which he'd long believed, but that was not a dogma accepted by most Americans. In an earlier private meditation, he'd concluded that it was probably true that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end, thinking it quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party to the conflict. But that was too Gnostic a doctrine to gain general credence. Addressing a devout, Bible-reading public, Lincoln knew he would be understood when he invoked the familiar doctrine of exact retribution, the belief that the punishment for a violation of God's law would equal the offense itself. Quoting from Matthew, he announced, "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh." That warning might seem to apply only to slaveholders, but Lincoln had consistently held Northerners as well as Southerners responsible for introducing slavery and for protecting it under the Constitution. Consequently, as God now willed to remove the offense of slavery, he gave to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came. How long, then, would the war last, and when would retribution cease? In the summer of 1864, Lincoln had said that the war might go on for 3 more years. More recently, he'd spoken of another year, or at least another 100 days of fighting. Now he offered no promises. Early in the address, he said flatly, "With high hope for the future, no prediction in regard to it is ventured." Returning to the subject, he made no firmer pledge. "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away." Then he went on to add one of the most terrible statements ever made by an American public official. "Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. This was a harsh doctrine, but it was one that absolved both the South and the North of guilt for the never-ending bloodshed. And by leaving the execution of this sanguinary judgment to the Almighty, Lincoln could turn in his final paragraph to the more limited responsibilities of mortals. Here he had a chance to voice his deeply held sense of the nation's debt to those who'd fought, suffered, and died in the Army and Navy. Recently, he'd expressed that feeling in a beautiful letter to Mrs. Lydia Bixby, a Boston widow who, he was told, was the mother of 5 sons who've died gloriously on the field of battle. "I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement," he wrote her, "and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost, and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom." Now he returned to that theme, promising to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan. With soaring eloquence, Lincoln concluded his address, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we're in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." After immense applause, Lincoln turned to Chief Justice Chase, and laying his right hand on an open page of the Bible, repeated after him the oath of office, ending with an emphatic, "So help me God." He then kissed the Bible, and, as a salvo of artillery boomed and the crowd cheered, he began his second term. Except for copperhead journals like the Chicago Times, which denounced the speech as so slipshod, so loose-joined, so puerile, that by the side of it mediocrity is superb, most newspapers gave Lincoln's second inaugural address a respectful, if somewhat puzzled, reception. In general, English editors praised it more highly than did the Americans. But the Washington National Intelligencer felt the president's final words equally distinguished for patriotism, statesmanship, and benevolence, deserved to be printed in gold. Lincoln wasn't troubled that his address wasn't immediately popular. He recognized that men aren't flattered by being shown that there's been a difference of purpose between the Almighty and them. But he was pleased when it received praise. He positively beamed when Frederick Douglass, who was in the throng at the White House reception after the inauguration, pronounced it a sacred effort. As Lincoln told Thurlow Weed, he expected it to wear well as, perhaps better than, anything I've produced. "Lots of wisdom in that document, I suspect," he said as he filed away his manuscript. Lincoln was so exhausted after the inauguration ceremonies that he took to his bed for a few days. There was nothing organically wrong. Despite his sedentary work, he continued to be a physically powerful man, but he often felt terribly tired. For some time he'd been losing weight, and strangers now noted his thinness rather than his height. Though he was only 56, observers at the second inauguration thought he looked very old. His photographs showed a face heavily lined, with sunken cheeks. Joshua Speed, who hadn't seen the president for some time, was shocked to find him looking so jaded and weary. "Speed," said Lincoln, "I'm a little alarmed about myself. Just feel my hand." It was, remembered Speed, cold and clammy, and his feet were obviously cold too, for he put them so near the fire that they steamed. Mary worried about his health. "Poor Mr. Lincoln is looking so broken-hearted, so completely worn out," she told Elizabeth Keckley, her dressmaker. "I fear he'll not get through the next 4 years." For months, she'd been urging her husband to keep a lighter schedule, and in order to get him away from his desk, she encouraged him to go to the theater frequently. He attended both Grover's Theater on E Street between 13th and 14th Streets and Ford's Theater on 10th Street between E and F Streets. Usually, Mary accompanied him, but occasionally he went with Tad or with one or both of his secretaries, and occasionally the Lincolns made up a small party of friends to occupy the presidential box. He enjoyed all sorts of theatrical entertainment, including Barney Williams, the blackface minstrel and Irish comedian, and he attended numerous plays that were little noted nor long remembered, like Leah, starring Avonia Jones, and The Marble Heart, featuring the brilliant young actor John Wilkes Booth. Shakespeare's plays appealed to him most. As a boy, he'd memorized the soliloquies contained in William Scott's Lessons in Elocution, and in Springfield he owned, and frequently read, his own copy of Shakespeare's works. But he'd never seen Shakespeare performed on the stage until he became president. After that, he rarely missed an opportunity. In February and March 1864, at one of the most dangerous periods of the war, he took time off from his duties to see the great tragedian Edwin Booth perform in Richard III, Julius Caesar, The Merchant of Venice, and Hamlet. He enjoyed them all. Shakespeare's wit delighted him, and he was enchanted by the magic of his language. The great tragedies, with their stories of linked ambition and guilt, especially appealed to him. As an often lonely leader, he found it easy to identify with Shakespeare's heroes. He could sympathize with their fears and understand their anxieties. "It matters not to me whether Shakespeare be well or ill acted," he remarked. "With him, the thought suffices." Still, he had decided ideas about how the plays should be performed. He insisted, for instance, that the choicest part of Hamlet was not the familiar to be or not to be soliloquy, but King Claudius's meditation, "Oh, my offense is rank, it smells to heaven." Once his fondness for Shakespeare led to an embarrassment. In August 1863, after seeing James H. Hackett as Falstaff in Henry IV, he wrote the actor commending his performance and expressing the hope that he would have a chance to make his personal acquaintance when he next performed in Washington. The president went on to say that he'd never read some of Shakespeare's plays, but that he'd gone over others, mentioning King Lear, Richard III, Henry VIII, Hamlet, and Macbeth, perhaps as frequently as any unprofessional reader. "I think nothing equals Macbeth," he added. "It's wonderful." Though the letter was intended to be personal, Hackett printed and distributed it, and newspapers had a field day, criticizing the president as would-be dramatic critic. To Hackett's apology, Lincoln replied that the hostile comments constitute a fair specimen of what's occurred to me through life. He added, in one of his most perfectly balanced sentences, "I have endured a great deal of ridicule without much malice, and have received a great deal of kindness, not quite free from ridicule. I'm used to it." Mary Lincoln also tried to divert her husband by going with him to concerts and the opera. The president was so impressed by the singing of Felicita Vestvali, Magnificent Vestvali, as the newspapers called her, that he attended her long-forgotten musical play called Gamaea or the Jewish Mother, not once but twice, and within a week returned to hear her in two other musical dramas. After 1863, when New York opera companies began offering a special Washington season, the Lincolns were regular patrons. They attended performances of Gounod's Faust, Weber's Der Freischütz, and Flotow's Martha, among others. Few of the president's comments on the music were recorded, but in March, when he heard the magic flute, he remarked to Colonel James Grant Wilson that the exceptionally large, flat feet of one of the leading female singers meant the Beatles wouldn't have much of a chance there. During most of the opera, Wilson recalled, the president sat in the rear of the box, leaning his head against the partition, paying no attention to the play and looking worn and weary. When Wilson asked if he was enjoying the opera, Lincoln replied, "Oh, no, Colonel. I have not come for the play, but for the rest. I'm being hounded to death by office seekers who pursue me early and late, and it's simply to get 2 or 3 hours of relief that I'm here." But when Mary asked if he would like to leave before the ending, he said, "Oh, no, I want to see it out. It's best when you undertake a job to finish it." When he was too tired to be diverted by either drama or opera, the president was able to forget his work and his worries only during the carriage rides Mary arranged to take with him several afternoons a week. These were times for quiet conversation, when Lincoln remembered the past and planned for the future. Though he was only into the first weeks of his second term, he looked forward to the end of his administration, when, he told Mary, he wanted to take the whole family to Europe. After that, he intended to return and go to California over the Rocky Mountains and see the prospects of the soldiers, etc., etc., digging gold to pay the national debt. He wasn't sure where they would ultimately make their home. Earlier, he'd always talked of returning to Springfield and practicing law. But now he thought less about settling than of roving and traveling. Lincoln could afford to think in rosy terms of the future. Unaware of the very considerable debts Mary had accumulated, he was confident that he and his wife were comfortably provided for. His estate had been worth about $15,000 in 1861, but it had grown rapidly during the war years. Most of his expenses while living in the White House were covered by congressional appropriations, so that he was able to save the bulk of his $25,000 annual salary and invest it in treasury notes or certificates of deposit. Interest and premiums on this paper, which amounted to nearly $10,000 over 4 years, he promptly reinvested. Because he didn't have time properly to manage his funds, indeed, at the time of his death, there were 4 uncashed salary warrants in his desk, he turned to Chase for advice. And in June 1864, brought over to Chase's desk a confused mass of treasury notes, demand notes, 730 notes, and other representatives of value, and asked for help in reinvesting his funds in government bonds. By April 1865, he owned, in addition to his house in Springfield, 200 acres of land in Iowa, a town lot in Lincoln, Illinois, and nearly $60,000 in government securities. Not an inconsiderable sum, and one certain to double in the next 4 years. During these few quiet weeks after the second inauguration, the Lincolns had a chance to talk about Robert, who was now in the Army. After graduating from Harvard in 1864, the president's oldest son wanted to enlist. Indeed, he'd been under considerable pressure to do so for some time, because critics didn't hesitate to brand him a shirker who was old enough and strong enough to serve his country. But his mother was afraid. She'd already lost two sons, and she grew hysterical at the possibility of losing another. When her husband tried to intercede for the boy, she replied, "Of course, Mr. Lincoln, I know that Robert's plan to go into the army is manly and noble, and I want him to go, but oh, I'm frightened he may never come back to us." Unwilling to do anything to upset his wife's precarious emotional balance, Lincoln encouraged Robert to go to Harvard Law School. But when he came home for the Christmas vacation in 1864, he was determined to see something of the war before it ends. In January, finally overcoming Mary's resistance, Lincoln, writing, "As though I was not president, but only a friend," asked whether Grant could give Robert some nominal rank and allow him to join his military family. Promptly, Grant welcomed the young man and commissioned him a captain. Grant made sure that Robert wasn't exposed to danger, and his principal duty was to escort visitors to the Army of the Potomac from one place to another. On March 20th, at Mrs. Grant's prompting, General Grant invited the president to come down to Army headquarters at City Point for a few days, suggesting that the rest would do him good. Lincoln accepted immediately, adding that Mrs. Lincoln and a few others would come with him. Despite a furious gale, the Lincolns, accompanied by Tad, Mary Lincoln's maid, White House guard William H. Crook, and Captain Charles Penrose, assigned by Stanton to protect the president, boarded the River Queen and sailed down the Potomac on March 23rd. They were eager to get away from Washington, which Mary thought was a place filled with their enemies, and which Lincoln knew was a city filled with office seekers. They wanted to learn how Robert was faring in the army. And, most of all, they needed a rest. They didn't get much of it at City Point, where they were welcomed with a round of lunches, dinners, receptions, parties, and dances. Tad probably had the best time. Aboard the River Queen, his investigating mind led him everywhere. And Crook reported he studied every screw of the engine and knew and counted among his friends every man of the crew. Once on land, he was a special pet of the soldiers, and he was allowed to accompany his father everywhere. Though Lincoln was unwell aboard the River Queen, he began to feel better once he was away from Washington and from the press of office seekers. On his first day at City Point, he rode out on a special train to General Meade's headquarters, where he saw evidence of recent fighting, heard a terrific Union bombardment of the Confederate lines at Petersburg, and witnessed an attack by the Sixth Corps on the enemy picket line. The next morning, he had a chance to greet General Sheridan's troops, which had cleaned the Confederates out of the Shenandoah Valley and had come to assist Grant in the final campaign against Richmond. That afternoon, he reviewed part of General Edward O. C. Ord's Army of the James at Malvern Hill. On another day, Lincoln visited the Army Field Hospital at City Point, where for more than 5 hours he moved from tent to tent, greeting each patient, pausing at the bedside of the seriously ill or wounded, and making a point of shaking hands with the hospitalized Confederates. He had very little time for relaxation, and his very careworn and fatigued appearance reappeared whenever he let his guard down. In particular, Mary reported, he found that the visit to the hospital, although a labor of love to him, fatigued him very much. But the cheers of the troops that he reviewed and the demonstrations of the sailors on the vessels he passed in the James River were exhilarating, and he gained strength from the scent of coming victory. On the whole, the Union soldiers and their officers were pleased by their president. To be sure, the very superior young Boston aristocrat, Colonel Theodore Lyman, attached to Meade's headquarters, found him the ugliest man I ever put my eyes on, with an offensive expression of plebeian vulgarity in his face. But after some conversation with the president, Lyman concluded he was a very honest and kindly man, who looked much like a highly intellectual and benevolent satyr. "I never wish to see him again," the colonel dismissed his commander-in-chief. "But as humanity runs, I'm well content to have him at the head of affairs." Mary Lincoln had a bad time on the trip down the Potomac on the River Queen. Highly nervous, she was greatly upset when her husband made the mistake of telling her that he dreamed the White House was on fire, and she insisted on sending not one but two telegrams to Washington to be sure everything was all right. At Army headquarters, she felt out of place, and the few other women who were present, like Julia Grant and Mary Ord, seemed not to pay sufficient deference to the wife of the President of the United States. Lincoln, intent on fulfilling his many obligations, gave her too little attention and assumed that she could cope in his absence. She could not. When Ord's troops were to be reviewed at Malvern Hill, the president and most of the men rode ahead on horseback, leaving Mrs. Lincoln and Mrs. Grant to proceed in an ambulance over roads calf-deep in mud. A sudden jolt bounced the ladies against the top of the carriage, crushing their bonnets and bumping their heads. Mary, who'd never fully recovered from her 1863 carriage accident, probably had an attack of migraine. When she finally arrived at the site of the review, she discovered that it had begun without her. Her husband was riding down the lines, accompanied by Mrs. Ord, a strikingly handsome young woman, whose appearance must have reminded Mary that she'd now become corpulent and her face heavy with permanent downturned lines. When Mrs. Ord rode up to pay her respects, Mary, now hysterical, positively insulted her, called her vile names, and asked what she meant by following up the president. That night, before the guests at dinner aboard the River Queen, Mary repeatedly attacked her husband for flirting with Mrs. Ord and demanded that General Ord be removed from command. Deeply mortified, the president tried to ignore his wife's remarks, but she continued her tirade of abuse until late in the night. For the next several days, ill and embarrassed, she spent most of her time in her cabin, and on April 1st, to her husband's undoubted relief, she went back to Washington, leaving Tad with his father. Once his wife was out of the picture, Lincoln could reveal that recreation wasn't his only object in going to City Point. His greatest worry now was that Union generals might let victory slip through their hands. Grant, preparing to launch the final assault of the Army of the Potomac against Petersburg, felt that the president's anxiety was unwarranted. So did Sherman. who'd now pushed into the Carolinas and was so sure of success that he felt able to leave his army and come up to City Point for a final conference on strategy. But Lincoln had had too many experiences with overconfident commanders, and he knew how wily and dangerous the Confederates still were. Again and again during his 2 weeks at the front, he expressed concern that Lee might break away from Grant, lead his forces into North Carolina, where they could join the remnants of the Confederate Army again under Joseph E. Johnston, and either fight another great battle or escape south to continue the war. He feared that Johnston might slip out of Sherman's grasp and be off south again with those hardy troops of his. "Yes," he told the general, "he'll get away if he can, and you'll never catch him until after miles of travel and many bloody battles." Equally important was the president's determination to keep control of any peace negotiations generally thought to be in the offing. Old Francis P. Blair, on his mission to Richmond, had made the dangerous suggestion that Grant and Lee should get together to talk about peace terms, and the Confederate commissioners at Hampton Roads had worked through Grant to secure the conference they desired with the president. More recently, Lee had directly approached Grant, asking an interchange of views on the subjects of controversy between the belligerents, and the president had been obliged to tell his commanding general that he must have no conference with General Lee unless it be for the capitulation of General Lee's army. "Such questions," Lincoln directed, "the president holds in his own hands and will submit them to no military conferences or conventions." Lincoln wasn't just ordering the generals to follow protocol. He wanted to make sure that any negotiations led not merely to a suspension of fighting, but to a peace that would ensure his war aims of the Union, emancipation, and at least limited equality. His worst fear, which he repeatedly expressed, was that once the Confederate armies were defeated, Southern soldiers would not return to their homes to accept citizenship under a hated rule, and with nothing but desolation and want through the South, the disbanded Confederate soldiers would be tempted to lawlessness and anarchy. Consequently, his objective was to secure not merely peace, but reconciliation. Bringing Grant, Sherman, and Admiral David D. Porter together for a conference aboard the River Queen on March 28th, Lincoln discussed the approaching end of the war and talked of offering the most generous terms in order to get the deluded men of the rebel armies disarmed and back to their homes. "Let them once surrender and reach their homes," he said, "and they won't take up arms again. Let them all go, officers and all. I want submission and no more bloodshed. I want no one punished. Treat them liberally all around. We want those people to return to their allegiance to the Union and submit to the laws." Chapter 21. I Will Take Care of Myself. The visit to City Point rejuvenated Lincoln. Once he was away from the nagging pressures of Washington, his health returned. Buoyed by the adulation of the soldiers and exhilarated by the sense that final victory over the Confederacy was at hand, he had a new sense of strength. After his visit to the Army Hospital, where he shook hands with patients for several hours, a surgeon expressed fear that his arm must ache from the exertion. The president smiled and, saying that he had strong muscles, picked up a heavy axe that lay beside a log. He chopped away vigorously for a few minutes and then, taking the axe in his right hand, extended it horizontally, holding it steady without even a quiver. After he left, some strong soldiers attempted to duplicate his feat, but failed. Lincoln had every right to be pleased with himself. After 4 exhausting years, he was now fully master of the almost impossible job to which he'd been elected. The only chief executive elected for 2 terms since Andrew Jackson, he was unquestionably the choice of the American people, not a minority or accidental president. He headed an administration and a bureaucracy that followed his leadership. As party leader, he commanded overwhelming support in both houses of Congress. He was commander-in-chief of the largest military and naval forces the country had ever raised, and at last they were functioning with machine-like efficiency. The United States Navy controlled the ocean, and after the capture of Fort Fisher, off Wilmington, North Carolina, in January, was strangling the Confederacy with its blockade. As Sherman's tough Western Army cornered Joseph E. Johnston's weakened forces in North Carolina, Grant was moving to the south of Petersburg and Richmond. On April 1st, he launched an attack with Sheridan's dismounted cavalry and Governor K. Warren's 5th Corps that crumpled Lee's right flank in the Battle of Five Forks and almost encircled Petersburg. Lee warned Jefferson Davis that he must be prepared to flee Richmond. Lincoln wanted to be in on the finish. On April 3rd, learning that Petersburg had been evacuated, he closely followed the Federal troops as they entered the city. The Secretary of War was horrified by the risk he was taking. "Allow me respectfully to ask you," Stanton scolded, "to consider whether you ought to expose the nation to the consequence of any disaster to yourself in the pursuit of a treacherous and dangerous enemy like the rebel army." But Lincoln, elated to learn that the Confederate government had fled and Richmond was in Union hands, brushed aside the warning. "I'll take care of myself," he promised Stanton. On April 4th, as soon as the Navy had removed most of the Confederate torpedoes in the James River, Lincoln set out with a small party to visit Richmond. When the USS Malvern, Admiral Farragut's flagship, couldn't pass a line of obstructions the Southerners had placed in the river, the President transferred to a shallow draft barge pulled by the tugboat Glantz. After the strong river current forced the Malvern against a bridge, the tugboat was detached to rescue it, and 12 sailors rowed Lincoln's barge upstream. The President was amused. "Admiral," he said to David D. Porter, who was in his party, "this brings to mind a fellow who once came to me to ask for an appointment as minister abroad. Finding he couldn't get that, he came down to some more modest position. Finally, he asked to be made a tide waiter. When he saw he couldn't get that, he asked me for an old pair of trousers." "But it's well to be humble," Lincoln concluded. Landing without notice or fanfare, the President was first recognized by some black workmen. Their leader, a man about 60, dropped his spade and rushed forward, exclaiming, "Bless the Lord! There's the great Messiah! Glory! Hallelujah!" He and the others fell on their knees, trying to kiss the President's feet. "Don't kneel to me," Lincoln told them, embarrassed. "That's not right. You must kneel to God only, and thank Him for the liberty you'll hereafter enjoy." Quickly, word of the President's arrival spread, and he was soon surrounded by throngs of blacks who shouted, "Bless the Lord, Father Abraham's come." As the small party walked up to Main Street, Six of the sailors from the barge, armed with carbines, headed the procession, and six others brought up the rear, with Lincoln leading Tad with his left hand and Admiral Porter in the center. It was a beautiful, warm day, and the president soon shed his long overcoat, which reached below his knees, but continued to wear his tall stovepipe hat, though he frequently removed it to wipe away big drops of perspiration on his forehead. Encountering a squad of New York soldiers, the president asked for directions to the headquarters of General Godfrey Weitzel, whom Grant had named to command the Union forces occupying Richmond. The soldiers escorted him to the Confederate White House, where he sank into a comfortable chair in what had been Jefferson Davis's study. After a little rest, he went on a tour of the building, and then had a simple lunch with Weitzel and his staff. While they were eating, the general's three-seated army hack, drawn by four horses, was brought to the front of the building, and Tad, who'd finished lunch early, climbed into the back seat and began to hold a reception, shaking hands with all the freedmen, and some whites as well, who crowded around. When the president emerged, there was cheering, and some members of the crowd threw their hats and bonnets into the air. Driving past St. Paul's Church, the president made a stop at the Virginia State House, which had housed the Confederate Congress. As one of his party recalled, it gave every evidence of hasty abandonment and subsequent looting. Members' desks and chairs were upset, official documents were scattered about, and Confederate $1,000 bonds littered the floors. Afterward, as the president drove through the more fashionable residential districts of the city, blinds or shades were drawn and no faces were to be seen. But in the working-class areas, he was surrounded by enthusiastic crowds. Proceeding south, Lincoln went through part of the business section, devastated by the fires that had broken out as the Confederates evacuated the city, and stopped at the hated Libby Prison, where so many Northern soldiers had been held during the war. In the late afternoon, he went aboard the Malvern, which had finally made its way through the obstructions on the James River. Even here, he wasn't allowed to rest undisturbed. Throughout the day, members of his entourage had been fearful of attempts on his life, for it was almost impossible to protect the president when so many people pushed close to inspect and admire him. There was a moment of panic when a man clad in a gray Confederate uniform stood in a second-story window and appeared to point a rifle directly at Lincoln, but no shot was fired and the group moved on. In the evening, two suspicious persons attempted to board the Malvern, claiming to bear dispatches for the president. Concerned for Lincoln's safety, Admiral Porter posted a guard outside his cabin door. The next morning, General Edward H. Ripley, who commanded one of Weitzel's brigades, brought a report from a Confederate soldier that the president was in danger and ought to take greater care if he went ashore again. Lincoln ignored the threat, saying, "I can't bring myself to believe that any human being lives who'd do me any harm." Lincoln's motive in going to Richmond was not just natural curiosity about the citadel of the Confederacy. It was a desire to help in the process of restoring peace. For this reason, he took time while in the Confederate White House to meet with John A. Campbell, one of the Southern commissioners at Hampton Roads, and the only high-ranking Confederate to remain in the capital. Urging the president to pursue a policy of moderation, magnanimity, and kindness toward the South, Campbell secured his ready agreement not to exact oaths, interfere with churches, etc., and in general to make no requisitions on the inhabitants of Richmond of any sort, save as to police and preservation of order. But these promises did little to solve the larger issues involved in bringing Virginia back into the Union. And for that purpose, Campbell suggested that Lincoln confer with the influential moderate leaders of the state, like R.M.T. Hunter, who were satisfied that submission was a duty and a necessity. The president invited Campbell to bring a delegation of such leaders aboard the Malvern the next morning. Campbell asked 6 or 7 influential Virginians to accompany him, but only Gustavus A. Myers, a prominent Richmond attorney, agreed to do so. Lincoln had General Weitzel at his side. The president began by restating his indispensable terms for peace: restoration of the national authority, no receding by the executive of the United States on the slavery question, and no cessation of hostilities short of an end of the war and the disbanding of all forces hostile to the government. If these were acceded to, he promised to consider other proposed conditions, in a spirit of sincere liberality. For instance, he promised to return property seized under the Confiscation Acts to any state that withdrew its troops from the Confederate Army. At the same time, he warned that if the war be now further persisted in, the costs would have to be paid from confiscated Confederate property. Campbell responded by saying that slavery was now defunct, and therefore no longer an issue between North and South. Virginia could be brought back into the Union if Lincoln offered a general amnesty. To cover appearances, there should also be a military convention to end the fighting. But there was no Confederate authority willing or able to sign such an agreement dismantling the Southern government. Jefferson Davis had avoided the decision, saying that only a convention of the Southern states could end the Confederacy. The Confederate Congress had refused to overrule its president. General Lee, as usual, stuck to his military duties and declined to act on political questions, such as the terms of peace. The situation was exactly what Lincoln had most feared. The war wasn't yet over, and further fighting and more bloodshed lay ahead. Even if there were no more pitched battles, thousands of Southern soldiers turned loose on the countryside would probably resort to guerrilla warfare. Society would be broken up, and anarchy was likely. To prevent these disasters, the president told Campbell and Myers he'd been thinking of a plan for the speedy restoration of Virginia to the Union. If he gave safe conduct assurances to members of the state's Confederate legislature, they could meet at Richmond and vote to withdraw the state from the Confederacy. It was not an idea that he had fully worked out, but it wasn't a completely novel one. Representative Ashley, a leading radical, had advanced a similar proposal in the last session of Congress. To secure stable governments in the South, he argued, the president may lawfully and rightfully treat with rebel officials and recognize them as the existing government. In his conversations with Grant and Sherman at City Point, Lincoln had probably discussed the possibility of dealing with Confederate state authorities, at least during a transitional period. But Lincoln recognized that this plan entailed risks. For one thing, it overturned the policy of non-recognition of the Confederacy that he and his administration had resolutely adhered to for more than 4 years. For another, in the case of Virginia, it raised problems about the legitimacy of the existing Unionist government headed by Francis Pierpont. To be sure, this Pierrepont regime had, as the president admitted, a somewhat farcical quality, since it governed only the areas of the state that were under Union guns. But both he and the Congress had repeatedly recognized it. These were weighty objections to be balanced against the president's desire to see the very legislature which had been sitting up yonder, pointing to the Capitol, to come together and to vote to restore Virginia to the Union and recall her soldiers from the Confederate Army. Eagerly, his listeners seized on his idea. As Weitzel later reported, Campbell and Myers assured Mr. Lincoln that if he would allow the Virginia legislature to meet, it would at once repeal the ordinance of secession, and that then General Robert E. Lee and every other Virginian would submit, that this would amount to the virtual destruction of the Army of Northern Virginia, and eventually to the surrender of all the other rebel armies, and would ensure perfect peace in the shortest possible time. Possibly their enthusiasm made the president pause, for he announced that he wouldn't make a decision until he returned to City Point. When he got back to Army headquarters, he tried to make his plan more precise, directing Weitzel to allow the gentlemen who've acted as the legislature of Virginia in support of the rebellion to assemble at Richmond in order to take measures to withdraw the Virginia troops and other support from resistance to the general government. Reporting his decision to Grant, the president added, "I do not think it very probable that anything will come of this." The Union Army, he observed sardonically, was pretty effectually withdrawing the Virginia troops from opposition to the government without the assistance of Campbell or other Confederate intermediaries. At City Point, the president received two pieces of news. Telegrams from Washington reported that Mary Lincoln, determined to show she'd recovered from her bout of paranoia, was returning to Army headquarters with a party that included Charles Sumner, the Marquis de Chambrun, a young French nobleman, Senator Harlan, whose appointment as Secretary of the Interior didn't take effect until May 15th, and his wife, and Attorney General Speed. At the same time, Stanton wired that Secretary Seward had been badly injured in a carriage accident, and that the president ought to return to the Capitol. Subsequent dispatches from Stanton indicated that the Secretary of State, though seriously hurt, was in no immediate danger, and Lincoln was able to stay on at Army headquarters for a few more days. Hoping to remain until the final Confederate surrender, Lincoln carefully studied the dispatches that Grant, Sheridan, and Meade forwarded to him. He rejoiced to read Sheridan's report that he'd routed the enemy at Burke's Station, which ended, "If the thing is pressed, I think that Lee will surrender." Promptly, the president wired Grant, "Let the thing be pressed." But when surrender didn't seem to be imminent, Lincoln and his party prepared to leave City Point on April 8th. Before their departure, he requested the military band on the River Queen to play the Marseillaise in honor of the Marquis de Chambrun, who, the president remarked, had to come all the way to America to hear the revolutionary song that was banned under the Second Empire. Then Lincoln asked the surprised band director to play Dixie. "That tune is now federal property," he announced, "and it's good to show the rebels that, with us in power, they'll be free to hear it again." On the slow river trip back to Washington, Lincoln was silent much of the time, absorbed in thought. He deflected any possibility of a political discussion with Sumner, who was always eager to press a radical reconstruction program on the president, and didn't mention his tentative plan to reconvene the Virginia legislature. Instead, he turned to literary subjects, and for several hours read to his guests on the River Queen passages from Shakespeare. From Macbeth, he chose the reflections of the king, who's murdered his predecessor, Duncan, only to be overtaken by horrible torments of mind. We will eat our meal in fear and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly. Better be with the dead than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice, domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further. Then, struck by the weird beauty of the lines, Lincoln paused, as Chambrun recalled, and began to explain to us how true a description of the murderer that one was. When the dark deed achieved, its tortured perpetrator came to envy the sleep of his victim, and he read over again the same scene. At about sundown on April 9th, Lincoln returned to a capital still celebrating the capture of Richmond and eagerly anticipating the surrender of Robert E. Lee. His first visit was to his Secretary of State, who was confined to his bed by the accident in which he had broken both his arm and his jaw. To keep Seward from trying to move his head, the President stretched out at full length across the bed, and, resting on his elbow, brought his face near that of the injured man. "I think we're near the end at last," he said, and he told of Grant's victories and of his visit to Richmond. He proposed to issue a proclamation for a day of thanksgiving, but the secretary whispered that he should wait until Sherman captured Joseph E. Johnston. As Seward drifted off to sleep, the president quietly left the room. That night, he learned that Lee had surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, and he immediately told Mary. At daylight the next day, the firing of 500 cannon gave the news to the entire capital. Guns are firing, bells ringing, flags flying, men laughing, children cheering, recorded Gideon Wells. All jubilant. Throngs of people collected around the White House, filling the north portico, the carriageways, and the sidewalks. "The crowds around the house have been immense," Mary wrote. "In the midst of bands playing, they break forth into singing." Repeatedly, they called for the president, and when he failed to appear, the shouting grew even louder. A great cheer rose when Tad appeared at a second-story window, waving a Confederate flag. Finally, Lincoln came out to say a few words. Anticipating that there would be a more formal demonstration the following night, he told the crowd, "I shall have nothing to say if you dribble it all out of me before." But again, he asked the band to play Dixie, one of the best tunes I've ever heard, and joked that he had a legal opinion from the Attorney General that the song was a lawful prize, since we fairly captured it. It was a busy day for the president, because he had to catch up the accumulated work that had piled up during his 2 weeks with the Army. A cabinet meeting dealt with only routine business, for Lincoln apparently didn't tell his associates of his conversations with Campbell in Richmond, or of his tentative agreement to allow the Virginia rebel legislature to reconvene. That subject was, however, much on his mind, and he summoned Governor Pierpont, the head of the Unionist government of Virginia, for a conference. Despite all distractions, he spent much of his time composing a speech for the next day. On April 11th, it seemed that the whole city turned out to celebrate. All the government buildings and many of the private houses were illuminated. Though the evening was misty, the illuminated dome of the Capitol could be seen for miles. Across the Potomac, Lee's home, Arlington, was brightly lit, and thousands of freedmen gathered on the lawn to sing the Year of Jubilee. An immense throng of people, many carrying banners, poured into the semicircular driveway leading to the north portico of the White House. After repeated loud calls, the president appeared in a second-story window just under the portico, and cheers upon cheers, wave after wave of applause, rolled up. Lincoln began to read from his carefully prepared manuscript in order to avoid any misunderstanding or misinterpretation of his ideas. But the light was bad. After unsuccessfully trying to hold a candle in one hand and the pages of his manuscript in the other, he beckoned to Noah Brooks, who took a place behind the draperies and held up the light while the president read. As he finished each page, he dropped it to the floor, where Tad scrambled about collecting them and, growing restless, importuned his father for another. "We meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart," the president began, and he expressed hope that the recent victories give hope of a righteous and speedy peace. Promising a day of national thanksgiving, he offered the nation's gratitude to General Grant, his skillful officers, and brave men. That much was to be expected. But the rest of the address was not at all what the crowd had anticipated. "The re-inauguration of the national authority" was his principal subject, and he warned that it was going to be fraught with great difficulty. "The more so since we, the loyal people, differ among ourselves as to the mode, manner, and means of reconstruction."
This ends Disc 32.